You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, I'm Bobby Herzberg, a Distinguished Senior Fellow in the F.A. Hayek Program in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And I'm very happy today to be joined by a colleague, an affiliated senior fellow of the Mercatus Center, but also a senior fellow in the Center for Economic Freedom at Fraser Institute in Canada, and also a senior research fellow at the Knee Center in West Virginia, at West Virginia University. So Matt Mitchell, our friend and colleague, has agreed to join me today to talk to you about public policy and how it relates to the areas of classical liberal thought, and how he has been able to apply the ideas of Austrian economics, public choice theory, and institutional analysis, the sort of core of mainline economics, to these areas in his own research and also in his efforts to try and help shape some of the policy process over the years. And we're going to focus mostly on healthcare, but I also want him to talk a little bit about some of the work he's done. He's done some very nice work recently on socialism, especially in Eastern Europe. And I'm sure he'll share a bit of that as well. Most relevant to his work in terms of healthcare, he's done much on certificate of need and for Mercatus and his years at Mercatus. But he's also co-authored with Peter Behtke a book on applied mainline economics that has taken the ideas of mainline economics first developed by Peter Behtke and applied them to these policy issues and showed the very great relevance. And I know that book is available as a free download on the Mercatus site. So if you're interested in afterwards, we'll make sure we have a reference to that so people that want to read further can download that very accessible text. So welcome, Matt, and welcome back to Mercatus. And thank you for joining me today to talk about some of these things.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Bobby. I'm really looking forward to the discussion.
Great. Well, let's get right started. I wanted to sort of begin with some general thoughts about what are the problems in healthcare from your own experience and your own research. I know you've done a great deal on the regulatory state and the areas of regulation around healthcare. And most everyone, when talking about healthcare in the United States, talks about the problems of healthcare, even though we think often we have quite good healthcare. We have access to a lot of things, but most people would agree it costs too much. Maybe there are access problems where some people can't gain access to either the providers that they want or in a timely manner. Maybe there aren't enough providers out there to deliver the kind of high demand for healthcare that we have. And then, of course, the overall budgetary issues that are associated with healthcare, particularly with Medicare running out of money and the trust fund and the high price of many of our subsidized health programs, and just the cost out of pocket to average citizens. So there's lots and lots of problems that exist in healthcare. Maybe you could explain for our listeners what some of your research discovered. Outline your research on certificate of need, for example.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I think healthcare is a sort of bizarre market insofar as it's characterized by this mind-blowing, you know, innovation that is really inspiring. And yet it also is characterized by mind-blowing lack of innovation in terms of the delivery of care. So, you know, it's, if you compare it to almost any other customer service industry, whether it's a hotel, I think is maybe one of the best examples you can think of, you know, it's just not very customer focused. And I think if you think about, you know, why is it that it's so innovative? I think part of it has to do with the fact that it's an incredibly important, you know, industry, and it draws some of the best minds in the world who really want to solve these important problems. I mean, everything from CAR T therapy to, you know, innovations in cancer treatment. It's really, really exciting. And I think part of people kind of get dazzled by that stuff, and they sort of forget that, geez, when it just comes down to the patient experience, it's really very awful, you know, in terms of you're so divorced from the costs and from the any sort of a price system. You're so divorced from the choices. You're often sort of, your time is treated as if it were worth, you know, nothing. and so all of that is in some ways, like, that's the stuff that we've already figured out in so many other industries. It's logistics, and we do it really, really, really well. It's just astonishing that easy stuff is what we do so poorly in healthcare. And the hard stuff, like, you know, mind-blowing treatments, is that's where we're really excelling. So it's an interesting field. And my area of focus is on this little corner of healthcare regulation called certificate of need laws. And part of the reason I'm interested in them is they're just so, again, bizarre. They're the sort of thing that when you first hear about it, you kind of think, no, that's not a thing. There's no way that's a thing. But it is. So these are rules that are found in about 2/3 of states that say if you want to open or expand a healthcare facility, so you want to add a hospital bed or a ambulatory surgery center, you want to open a substance treatment center or a psychiatric care facility, you've got to go before a board or a regulator and prove that your community needs the service in question. So that's really important, the proving the need part, as you can, you know, kind of tell from the title of the regulation. The idea here is they're not going to ask you, what are your qualifications? What's your safety record? What's the adequacy of your facility? None of that. They are just simply interested in second guessing your claim that whatever service you want to provide is needed. Now, that makes it a weird regulation, right? There aren't too many regulations like this, but it gets weirder. In the process of proving need, in most of these states, about half of these states, it's quite possible that your would-be competitor can sit on the board evaluating your application or setting the criteria for which the regulator evaluates your application. So it's like McDonald's being able to, you know, evaluate whether Burger King is allowed to come into town. Okay, so that's odd. Another oddity is that even in a state where that's not the case, in all but 6 certificate of need states, your competitor is invited to be a part of the process. So they can come, they can object to your application. They can say, hey, I don't want Bobby coming into my town. I don't think we need her services because, you know, we're already offering enough. Then you start to dig in further. One of the criteria by which they assess need is the language that they'll use in the statutes and in the regulations is duplication of services. And so they'll say, you know, you basically don't need a new service if it might duplicate an existing service. Well, what the statutes and the regulations call duplication, you and I call competition. So it virtually guarantees a local monopoly. And then finally, if you look at the formulas also empower the incumbent providers. So they will use formulas to determine need. And the way they do this, one of the popular ways to do it is they'll look at the current healthcare resources in the community and see what the utilization rate of those resources are. So they might say, okay, let's count all the beds. And if under 70% of the beds are being used, then we will deny any new applications for a new bed. Okay, if you're an existing provider and you know your would-be competitor is likely to get denied if you don't have a lot of your beds full, then you have an incentive to make sure that you've got a lot of useless equipment that you don't need for any other purpose other than to manipulate the regulation to make sure you don't have a competitor. So you make sure you've got a lot. If you have 10 beds, make sure that fewer than seven of them are being used, and you'll virtually guarantee that you won't get any competition. So it's just a weird regulation. And so I've kind of spent, I guess now I'm sad to say, the better part of a decade studying it and trying to better understand it.
So can you tell us how did we get this crazy regulation in place in the first place? And what are the consequences of that for the cost of healthcare, for access to providers? You said, you know, most states have this, but not all states. So we must have some mechanism for understanding whether or not this makes sense by comparing across those states.
Okay, so first of all, like a lot of weird ideas, it started in the 30s. And so you actually saw certificate of need regulation in a few other industries before healthcare. Transportation industries they're relatively common. To this day, you still will see them, for example, in moving companies. They're often required to have get certificates of need. Your listeners are almost certainly familiar with the famous phrase, laboratories of democracy, from Justice Brandeis's dissent in the New ICE case. New ICE was actually a certificate of need case. And as the name implies, the state required a certificate of need for people who were selling ice. So it's in a few other industries. But in healthcare, it really got a big jump in the 70s. So what happened was New York State had adopted a certificate of need law in, I think, 1964. And then about a decade later, the federal government adopted the National Health Planning and Resources Development Act. And what that did is it threatened to withhold federal funding, healthcare funding, from any state that didn't adopt a certificate of need regime. Now, if you read the first couple pages of this act, it's really interesting. It's a good example of what some Austrian economists call the dynamics of government intervention, because it basically says, gosh, healthcare is out of control. The cost curve, we got to bend the cost curve. Healthcare price inflation is really high, and it's probably because of government intervention. Like the language of the bill actually says, you know, too much government intervention in healthcare. So as a result, we need to intervene in this case. And I don't know, you know, the details of whether that was needed to get some Republican holdouts or something. I find that very odd. But the basic idea, at least initially, was, okay, we've got this third-party payer problem. When a patient goes in to see a doctor, the doctor has a lot more information. You also have asymmetries of information. And they can propose new, expensive, fancy-sounding treatments that may not be worthwhile, and the patient kind of won't know, and the patient's not going to pay anyway. It's going to be an insurer or the government that pays. So basically, doctors might overprescribe care. That's essentially the kind of rationale. And there was some, they had some empirical evidence. There's a researcher named Milton Romer who had documented that in places where there's lots of beds, they tend to be filled beds. And so this got characterized into the pithy phrase, or shortened into the pithy phrase, that a built bed is a filled bed. And so the basic idea was, okay, let's just take away, let's ration the expensive, fancy stuff, make sure that we don't have the fancy equipment, and then the doctors won't be able to put people in those fancy beds, and therefore we'll save money. From a basic, you know, perspective of you know, Econ 101, they're talking about a supply restriction, you know, sliding the supply curve left. It's weird to think that by sliding the supply curve left, you're going to, you know, do anything but raise prices and lower quantity and quality. But if you put it in the framework of thinking that they're not really necessarily trying to restrain cost per unit or cost per service, they're actually just trying to limit the amount we spend. That's not so irrational, at least if you think that that's a good goal. I'd say it's irrational because I'm not positive it's a good goal. But let me put that in perspective. You know, if you had a certificate of pizza necessity that required any pizza joint to have to get a a con before they can open, you would predict there would be fewer pizza parlors in your town. And you would also predict that the price per pie is going to go up. But it's quite possible that my family might spend less on pizza in a year because you're basically rationing my access to pie, right? And so that's kind of the weird framework that they have, you know, based on these rules.
That's really helpful. And it shows sort of the economics that underlie healthcare are not different really than the economics that underlie everything. It's the policy that tries to alter those economics that often create some of the glitches that we see that explain these. So there are states that don't have this. What's their experience? Have they fallen apart? Have costs gone out of control in the states that don't have a certificate of need rule in place?
Yeah, they have not. And so that's kind of the other thing that makes it an interesting topic of discussion. So I mentioned that there was this federal statute in 74. What happened is basically within a decade, there had started to emerge quite a bit of data to suggest that these rules are not helping. There were already some studies at that time. And so Democratic Congress and a Republican President Reagan eliminated the federal inducement. And then suddenly a bunch of states started getting rid of con laws. Actually, the best time for getting rid of con reform was right when that federal statute, that federal inducement went away. About 12 states got rid of their con laws within a couple of years. And so now at this point, it depends on how you count, you know, whether do you count a regime that only requires a con for one thing like ambulance services, as we have in New Mexico, or are you really counting con regimes that regulate a lot of things, especially that are at the core of healthcare, like hospital beds? But basically now between 35 and 39 states have certificate of need laws and the others don't. And if you look at the breakdown of the population, it's interesting because quite large states like Texas and California don't have certificate of need laws. So what ends up happening is if you look at it by population, between 30 and 40% of Americans live in a state without a certificate of need law. And these are rich states, poor states, urban, rural, intercontinental, coastal, whatever. They're all kinds of different characteristics. And as a result, and they've gotten rid of their cons or pared their con programs back at different times. And so it's really a very handy, you know, kind of policy experiment that is quite amenable to research. Now, it's so amenable to research that I, you know, set out to read all the papers that had looked into this. And that was a huge mistake because I just didn't realize how many dang papers there were. So I found over 128 peer-reviewed academic papers that have looked at the effect of certificate of need on something, either access to care, quality of care, cost of care, access for underserved populations, you name it. And essentially what I find is the evidence is really overwhelming that these rules do not work as advertised. So for every, you know, one study that finds a good effect, there are five that find bad effects. A majority of the studies in every category find that con undermines access, undermines quality, undermines, raises costs. And sometimes they're, you know, by significant amounts. So like people in the average patient in a certificate need state has access to 30% fewer hospitals. They have access to 14% fewer ambulatory surgery centers. A large black-white disparity in the provision of angiography, which is an effective screening technique, disappeared when New Jersey got rid of its con law. You find that costs, per unit go down between 5 and 9% in states that repeal con laws. You find that quality outcomes improve after states repeal con laws. So there are higher incidence of death from heart attack, heart failure, and pneumonia in con states relative to non-con states. You find that there are more complications from heart attack and heart failure in con states relative to non-con states. And you find that, if you look at things like nursing staff ratios, or you even look at patients being physically restrained, it's more likely that nursing home patients will be physically restrained in a con state than a non-con state. So it's just, remarkable, dimension after dimension after dimension. The rules do not work as was hoped, but they do actually work as applied mainline economics would predict.
Exactly. So that's what I'd like to get to. So One of the questions is, given all of that you've just presented, which seems very compelling, why in the world do so many states, three quarters of the states, still possess these rules that constrain and harm their citizens? What is it that gets in the way? And how can mainline economics help us understand that?
Okay, so I think the first thing that gets in the way is just rational ignorance. So I rarely talk to a normal person who has heard of a con law, even if they live in a certificate of need state. They're just not really on the radar. Even if they've heard of it, it takes, you know, we've been on this call for a few minutes. It takes quite a bit of time to just wrap your head around what in the world are these things. I think if people kind of know about them, they also have a sort of naive view of it that, oh, it's a healthcare regulation. So it must be there to protect the health and safety of the patient. Like, you don't want unfettered free markets in healthcare because that could be dangerous. Even though, as I said at the outset, they're not really assessing the quality or safety record of the providers or anything. So I think that looms large. And then you combine that with just this idea of concentrated benefits and diffuse costs, and those who benefit from these rules are big, politically active hospitals, big hospital associations, and those who lose are the patients, the payers, and smaller providers. Now, the smaller providers are more aware of these, and they're really ticked off about them. And in just about every state, you can find some group of people, providers, and maybe even some politicians who are like, kind of like I was when I first heard about these. They're sort of like amazed that these things exist, and just they're indignant about their existence. So that's good, but they're just so overwhelmed by the political organization of the big hospitals. So that's kind of the dynamics of it.
And we know from our work on rent seeking and all of the rest of it that that is what mainline economics would predict if you set up these kinds of rules, that they become much harder to eliminate. Now, what I like about how you've presented all of this is it is this one little corner, but all of healthcare is filled with these little corners that operate in very similar fashion. And you've noted some of the key problems, the information asymmetries between people who are actually purchasing the good, the patients, but not purchasing it in a direct way so that they're not acting like a normal consumer, having an asymmetry with a provider and insurers who do have the information about the nature of this market. And so we have a lot of problems in what some might call market failures that take place in healthcare. So how can a sort of classical liberal approach to some of these, a sort of mainline economics approach, help us to try and sort out and make people aware that when, especially if we are doing reforms, if we are discussing changes, if we are pushing for the elimination of at least some of the con rules, how can we use those kinds of theoretical ideas that we've tried to develop at the Mercatus Center and transmit through these programs? How can we use those to try and convince people and make the reform process better? And I know you have quite a bit of experience doing testifying and going before legislators. What has worked in trying to get some of these ideas across into sort of mainstream political debates?
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of things there. Great question. And there's so many different ways I could take it. So I think one thing I would say, just in terms of social change and trying to help people wrap their heads around the idea, I found it very, very helpful to point to examples and to say, look, I know you've been told stories that if your state got rid of this certificate of need, that you would have all the rural hospitals would just go away, which, by the way, is a weird idea. Like, without a supply restriction, we would lose supply. You know, the most straightforward interpretation is that a supply restriction restricts supply, I think. And if you get rid of it, it's probably going to increase supply, but whatever. But they've been told these ideas. And so what I try to say is, you know, kind of what I already mentioned is, look, we don't have to speculate. This is extremely well studied. All we need to do is open our eyes and look at the 30 to 40% of Americans that live in a state with either limited or no con and what's happening to them. And so I think that does tend to appeal to legislators because they can wrap their heads around it. Now, almost all legislators then will say, well, that may be so, but my state is different. So that is where it is very helpful. If you can find specific examples, because that's the way the human brain works, the human brain likes stories, right? And so I usually try to keep in mind some examples. And if I can get them from the state where I'm talking, that's even better. So let me leave you with it, or let me give you a couple of these examples, because it does kind of help you understand how this thing works. So a common rationale for certificate of need is to provide care for underserved populations. The problem, and this gets into Austrian economics, but it's what I like about this is it's a way to talk about the knowledge problem in Austrian economics without actually having to talk about the knowledge problem, which sounds dry and boring. Okay, so in New York, there were a group of all-female Hasidic Jewish women who wanted to start an all-female Hasidic Jewish women ambulance service. And the idea was, okay, if you have fallen in your shower and you need medical help, you don't want a bunch of dudes showing up and finding you in this compromised position. So let's have an ambulance service that serves the needs of this particular community. So what are we talking about? We're talking about patient subjective preferences, their knowledge, what they care about. We don't have to use those words. We just have to say that's the kind of thing that somebody in a market can be really responsive to. But the regulator looked at it and said, nope, sorry, there's enough ambulance services. Because they're not looking at the type of detailed knowledge of the market that really the patient, you know, cares about or the provider cares about. So they rejected it. Now, over the long run, they sued, and that is a good story. The ambulance service got its certificate of need and they're in operation. But there are other sad stories. A similar one is there's a large Nepalese community in Kentucky, and a couple of folks there wanted to start a home healthcare business that, again, tailored to the specific cultural and linguistic needs of that community. They were denied because they said, sorry, we have enough home healthcare in that community. Again, not taking account of the local information of time and place and culture. In Louisiana, there was a woman named Angela Newell Davis, and she wanted to start Ursula Newell Davis, and she wanted to start what's called a respite care business. And so this is a business where you provide some time off to people who are taking care of loved ones who are either, you know, aging or maybe special needs children. And you say, you know, I'll come and help you for an hour or two while you can go get your hair cut, you know, go to the grocery store, go on a date, right? And so she produced all of this research from local politicians and community leaders saying, we need this service in our community. It's desperately needed. She was a social worker, so she had a lot of, you know, good background in providing the service. And she even went out of her way to get the certificate of need required her to have an office facility. And knowing, you know, what this community, that these are people that might be coming into the office with kids, she made sure that there was a bathroom in the office so that they didn't have to go down the hall. Now, just back out and think about this for a second. Remember what the whole rationale here is we're trying to stop the provision of expensive capital, you know, expenditures. It's home health. Home health doesn't need an office. You just need a cell phone, right? And so here the regulation actually encouraged her to spend tens of thousands of dollars on an office that's totally unnecessary in order to get the certificate of need. Anyway, she was denied. All she got was a form letter saying, sorry, no. No explanation for why it is. So you start to tell those types of stories, and I do think that begins to resonate with people. But it's an uphill battle.
Always. I think it's always an uphill battle. And I think one of the things that is most interesting to me in health is the degree to which we recognize subjective preferences in every other market, every other arena of our lives. We don't all watch the same things on stream the same things. We don't listen to the same music. We don't wear the same kinds of clothes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, eat the same kinds of food. But somehow in healthcare, there is this desire for the ideal good. And I think one of the things I found very helpful about our mainline approach to these things is this recognition that consumers have different preferences, even about things that are core, like an essential, like healthcare. No one wants to die, but the way in which we go about achieving that goal is quite different. And what our balance is between the risks that we're willing to take and how much we're willing to spend and the inconvenience to us in other ways, other health factors that may be associated with having to go to a hospital that's quite a bit more distant because certificate of need wouldn't let them put a clinic setting closer to your home, which again, for rural people, is very much part of the explanation for some of the difficulties of trying to get the appropriate care. That driving, even if it's not as good a care as they can provide an extra 50 miles away, may result in better health care for that person because they are now getting that health care. Whereas if they have to go 50 miles each way, they may not get that care at all. And we see this especially with chronic care. One of the advantages of markets that I like to note and that come out, I think, in your work as well, is it is creative. So during COVID, when we had no alternative, all of a sudden telehealth, which has been around forever, since there were telephones, we've had telehealth, but it has never caught on. And part of it is the billing for it under all of the government programs and things meant if you couldn't bill for it, you weren't going to provide it. People think that seems so mean and rude. And certainly providers would never do that. But the reality is, if it comes down to I can see patients in the office and get paid, or I can drive out to you, or I can call you on the phone, but I'm not going to get paid for all of that, people will make those kinds of decisions and act accordingly to their incentives. So it's one of the things that we really push for is this logic that incentives matter, and then the institutions that arise around those incentives matter. And that if we don't understand that, and if we don't build it into our policies, then our policies will have the kind of problems that we see with certificate of need as a great example of how people will respond to the incentives that are there. And so for the existing providers, the incentives are very clear. Nobody wants to compete. I don't want to compete with other scholars if it means I'm not going to have a job or that I'm going to make less income next year. And so these are just basic things that economics teaches us and that mainline economics emphasize, but that policymakers seem to sometimes ignore in making health policy. What can we do to try to change that? What can average citizens do to try and change that? Are there ways that they can be more attentive to what's going on in their own arena with regard to these healthcare issues?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, I think one way to think about it a little bit is healthcare is this big Gordian knot. And it's, I mentioned already the dynamics of intervention. If you think about how we got here, you know, how is it that price controls in World War II, you know, made it difficult for employers to attract talent? So they had to offer some kind of compensation that wasn't covered by the price controls. So they started offering fringe benefits like health insurance. And then they didn't tax health insurance. So that became then, you know, better for, you could offer more services to your protect or more compensation to your potential employee through a more generous healthcare package. So then that ties healthcare to employment, and now you're further divorcing the patient from the selection of care, and that now you have people lobbying to make sure that health insurance is not exactly health insurance, but it's prepaid healthcare, and it's covering all kinds of totally foreseeable things. Your employer could offer you car insurance tax free, and then you start asking demanding that car insurance pay for things like a oil filter or gas. No, that's not really what insurance is designed for. So you just see all that this instinct that, well, it's just so complicated. We just need to either we need one more intervention to try to make it better, or we should just throw up our hands and say, we got to move on. And this is never going to work. And I communicate to people about this is, think about, surely you, most of us at some point or another have encountered a friend who's dealing with complex issues. I had a friend a while ago who had a drinking problem, and that led to a work problem, and that led to a marriage problem, and that led to a lack of a house problem. And now you start to look at it and it's like, oh my God, it's so complex. Everything's intertwined. And you just start to say, this is just a desperate situation. That's kind of, I feel like, the way healthcare is. It's one problem led to another, and it sort of just seems desperate. Well, the answer, this was a very smart individual who knew the analogy I was making. I said, just think about solving a complex set of equations. You don't try to solve it all at once. You just pick the simplest equation, solve that one, and then see if you can then move on to the next one, on to the next one, on to the next one. And you can do it. It'll take you 3 or 4 pages, but you'll get it done. And that's kind of what I would say here is like, okay, let's just start with something simple. Okay, don't restrict the supply of healthcare. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Then once you got that, maybe we can start thinking about addressing some of these pricing problems. Or maybe we should treat employer-provided healthcare the same as we treat employer-provided cash, wages. Now, maybe we should, make it easier for people to buy insurance across state lines. Those kind of, you just kind of saw, let's just work on it one problem at a time. And then, lo and behold, you can start to unravel this knot that seems just overwhelming and seems like it's crushing and there's no way out of it.
I think that is so much of the problem. And being at the table, I think that's another issue, which is, I think, an important reminder to people who care about freedom and care about limited government and some of the issues that we often discuss and that organizations work towards. If you care about those ideas and you want to see improvement, not because you want to take away healthcare, but because you want to actually deliver better healthcare at a better price, then you've got to be at the table offering up those suggestions in the policy arena. If you're not at the table, the folks at the table are happy. And I think that's one of the things you saw with Certificate of Need in your work is the people at that table were the competitors that did not want to, and they were the experts on how many beds you need and how do you deliver this care. And that creates this sort of problem is this asymmetry of information means that experts frequently drown out other voices, voices of average people whose preferences may not be consistent by saying that's not the way good healthcare should be. So how do we fight those kinds of challenges? How do you get people to be willing to be at the table even when they don't think we should have another big government program?
So where I've seen success is in sort of multi-pronged approaches. And there have been successes. That's the other thing that's interesting about this issue is it's difficult, but it is not hopeless.
Can you tell us about one of those successes?
Yeah. So South Carolina, let me start with Florida did a significant repeal a few years ago, got rid of the certificate of need requirement for new hospitals and for hospital expansions. And it looked at the time like, wow, this is great. It's the best we're going to we can see a big state repealing a lot of its program. And then just a few years later, very quietly, Montana got rid of 8 of its 9 con requirements. And that one didn't make people almost didn't notice that one, which was great in some ways. And then South Carolina last year, huge state, huge reform, far more significant than what either Florida or Montana did. They got rid of, if I recall, it's something like they were a really extensive con program, something like 27 services and procedures required cons. And they got rid of all but one, and that for nursing homes, which is a very hard one to get rid of. So there are success stories, and usually it seems to me like it's people get organized. We talk a lot about concentrated benefits and diffuse costs, and that it's good to get your side. It's easier to organize if you have a few people, but it's also easier to organize if you get organized. you just have people who say, "Look, let's get on the phone." And let's try to call as many different potential stakeholders as possible. I've been at hearings where they had, I was really impressed, they had patients. There was one patient who, he was a really promising engineer, and he had a rock climbing accident and had a very severe brain injury. And he testified, he and his mother testified about, they had to basically leave their state in order for him to get care. That whoever identified that this is a person who is bearing the cost of this regulation, let's reach out to them and find them and get them organized. Like that's, I don't know the story behind how they did it, but that was impressive. Similarly, they had just a terrible story of a mother who lost her son to addiction. Again, we have certificate of need. One of the most common certificate of need requirements is for substance use services. Again, these are not very capital intensive. So they're sort of silly cons in the first place. They don't even make sense on the original rationale. And who in their right mind thinks that in 2024, we have too many substance treatment centers, right? Like right. That's just not a problem we're facing.
Especially coming out of the COVID experience. So that was another question I wanted to ask. Coming out of COVID, in some ways, many of us experienced policies with regard to healthcare that impacted so much of our life. And one of the things about health policy more generally is it tends to be quite individualized and sort of random almost. But this was one that was large and more universal. And so the way in which decisions were made and the way in which regulators decided one thing versus another, whether they were right or wrong or balanced the different things in the correct way or the correct way that an individual might think was correct, is neither here nor there. The reality is decisions were being made for millions, hundreds of millions of people at a time, and often didn't serve the interests of lots of other, maybe 100 million other people at the time. And so it was one of those opportunities for seeing maybe making these kinds of decisions generally speak to the problem of finding an ideal healthcare, the right level of healthcare, the right actions in healthcare, and thus giving maybe rise to people more willing to think about individualizing and decentralizing some of these things. Have you seen any sort of, effect that might have come out of our general experience with this is how government plans in this arena?
Yeah, definitely. So, I'm reminded of Rahm Emanuel's observation that you never let a crisis go to waste. Milton Friedman said something somewhat similar. He said, when a crisis arises, whether real or imagined, people turn to the ideas that are lying around. Naomi Klein wrote a book just ripping Milton Friedman apart for that. But I think as if he was like rooting for a crisis. I think Milton and Rahm, I think, were absolutely right that it's during crisis that people rethink things. Shouldn't be a controversial thing to say. And they rethink things sometimes in a bad way and sometimes in a good way. And so one of the things that I think that was good here is that COVID put certificate of need on the radar for a lot of people. So most certificate of need states actually relaxed their con laws during COVID. And there is some evidence that there was some improvement in care in those states. I actually did a study with Thomas Stratman and didn't find evidence that there was much improvement in care, but some other colleagues found some evidence that there was. What happened was in most of those states that relaxed their con laws, they basically said, you know, you don't have to get a con as long as there is a state of emergency. As soon as the governor rescinds the state of emergency, then you got to go back to business as normal. And unfortunately, by doing it that way, a lot of people didn't even apply for cons because then they would have had to surrender their extra beds. They would have had to surrender their extra hospital wing, you know, and so they weren't going to do that. The other thing is that, you know, this isn't the kind of thing that you can just, you know, wave a wand, change a policy and expect change suddenly. You know, what good is 20 extra beds if you don't have a wing in the hospital to put them in? And the wing has been, you know, restricted for 5 decades. You're not going to find, if you have capacity restricted on the hospital, you're not going to be able to expand capacity on the beds. So the experiment itself, I think, wasn't, you know, as extraordinary as we would like, but it did put it on the radar. And so I think that's essentially what happened in South Carolina is people said, what? We have this rule? That's crazy. Let's get rid of it. And so you're still seeing that happen in a lot of other states where just raising the awareness of the issue because of that crisis, I think it has helped.
Yeah, that was my sense of it as well, not having done research into it, but just the sense that people recognized, and we definitely saw it in areas like telehealth and other regulatory areas that had been quite limited previous to COVID. All of a sudden, because of emergency, those were the only game in town, the only alternative for lots of, especially chronic care during lockdown periods, et cetera. And as a result, now people like them and have gotten a taste for a new market. And that is the real advantage of the innovation that emerges when markets are freed to permit smart providers and smart folks out there thinking of different ways to do it.
Let me just piggyback on that real quick. I do think I kind of mentioned this idea of the proof of concept that is helpful for legislators, but it's also very helpful for patients too. And that, or any kind of consumer, you know, I look back at the successful deregulations, and there are a few of them. They almost always involve some sort of a proof of concept. So, you know, Alfred Kahn wanted to deregulate his own agency, get rid of the Civil Aeronautics Board, and Ted Kennedy helped here. Ted Kennedy was able to point out in these Senate hearings that, the intrastate route between San Francisco and San Diego, that's about as long as the route from San Diego to Las Vegas, which is interstate. And one of them is regulated, the interstate one, but not the intrastate one. And gee, the prices are half as much if you're it's not regulated. So that proof of concept really helped. And Alfred Kahn then used that to convince Carter and others to get rid of his whole agency. The same kind of thing I think is happening a little bit in healthcare is people are being willing to leave their state for care. So with Florida dramatically paring back their con program, I think that added a big impetus for folks in South Carolina because you saw patients literally driving to go get care. And now you start, if you have to compete with another state for your terrible, you've got a terrible self-inflicted regulation, that is an incentive to get rid of that regulation.
Yeah, and it's even more the case as you add technologies and things that allow people to see folks in other states without having to even drive to the other state for a lot of tests and other things, because they can do it through now computerized systems for much of it and provide quite good care. And so I think that that the market and technology will move this even when certificate of need, as long as you can pay for it. And that's where the linkage between how we pay for care and how it is delivered becomes, I think, so critical in this regard. I know you're also, while you've been, you know, very prominent in the debate about certificate of need and in these health regulatory arenas, you also do broader work on planning and freedom and other things with regard to state interventions, and especially in some states that have coming out of socialism, some of those debates. So would you share some of your other research that, again, links some of these ideas of mainline economics to important policy areas of regulation outside of the area of health?
Sure. Yeah. So this is a project that the Fraser Institute sponsored. It's called the Realities of Socialism Project, and it involves five different books. And I was a co-author on two of them, and then helped contribute some chapters to a third one. But they essentially are looking at the real world example of and the reality of what it was like to live in a socialist, or an actual socialist economy. You know, this is a time where recent surveys show that about 50% of 18 to 34 year olds think that socialism would be an improvement over the current system. And if you look at the US, Canada, Australia, and the UK, it's also a time when the share of the population with a working memory of the Berlin Wall falling is, increasingly getting smaller and smaller, right? And so we started this project. You know, one of the things when I started it, I was doing the math on the timing, and I realized, gee, I'm writing this project. The time between me writing this project and the fall of the Berlin Wall is exactly equal to the time between the death of Hitler and my birth. And I wondered, does a baby being born today get the same lessons that I got about Hitler, except about socialism? Like, I grew up and was never, ever, ever under any illusion about how terrible the Nazi experiment was, right? But I'm not so sure that a baby being born today is taught, you know, that the actual real world experience of socialism led to the death of tens of millions of people, you know, 30 million people in the Chinese famine, 7 million people in the famine engineered by Stalin, well over hundreds of thousands of people, just, you know, the victims of state murder. Even just on a more pedestrian level, people being forced in these bizarre experiments to have to have their houses socialized. If you had more than 9 square meters of space, guess what? That's bourgeois. You're going to have 2 or 3 other families moved into your home, and you have 3 families living, working out of the same kitchen, families, you know, shoved into their bedrooms. You had, you know, the disastrous experiment of collectivization of agriculture, the mass surveillance, you know, children over the age of 12 having to be put in jail for the crime of having a relative in jail, you know, just terrible, terrible atrocities. And I don't think people quite, you know that or taught that or remember it. So we have a couple of books, one that specifically focuses on the experience of Estonia, and one that focuses on the experience of Poland, that not only tell the story of going into socialism. So the Poland book is The Road to Socialism and Back, but also emphasizing the experience of coming out of it. The Estonia book is The Road to Freedom, because Estonia went from one of the least free countries in the world to arguably, you know, one of the freest places on the planet by several indicators. And so we tell the story of, you know, what happened in terms of people's experiences, what happens in terms of the promises of socialism and the reality of socialism, and then what happened on their way out. And so it was a really fun project to dig my teeth into.
Well, it sounds extremely important, and I would recommend to all of our listeners that they take a look at the FraserInstitute.org site and look for those those texts.
And one thing I'll add is we have the texts, but then we've got just tons of videos, podcasts, infographics, all kinds of stuff that makes it really shareable, instant kind of things that you look at it for 2 minutes and you can wrap your head around it. So it's more than just the text too, realities of socialism.
That's great. And it's such an important lesson. And it, in some ways, it makes healthcare look more manageable.
Yeah.
Although we wouldn't want to count the number of people who may have died as a result of some of the limitations that exist in any arena when you have that vast an arena, but obviously not on the scale and not on the sort of economy-wide level that you're talking about with some of these countries. And but I also saw that you had written some on just a recent blog on some research about the Danish social welfare state, because one of the things we often hear is, well, other countries have nationalized health and they're doing it and they're not spending as much as we are. And all of that is true at one level, but it doesn't tell the whole story. And you look at some of the trade-offs that are required when we put it in place. Denmark has a wonderful healthcare system by all indications, but it doesn't come without a cost. So could you share some of that with us as well?
Yeah, so a couple of things about Denmark. I mean, one of the first things to note, and one of the reasons why we talk about this is because it's perceived as a socialist state. And so probably the first off the bat is just to emphasize that it is by no means a socialist state. It is a one of the most economically free countries in the world on several important dimensions. It's got very few regulations. It's got superb protection of private property and a legal system. It's got excellent monetary policy institutions that ensure sound money. It's very open to free trade. Barriers to starting a business and running a business are quite low. The one thing that is an exception is it does have a large government. It has a relatively large welfare state. But even that is different from a lot of people's perceptions. So it's commonly assumed that the big welfare states of the Scandinavian countries, surely they must be financed through taxes on the wealthy. And that's really not true. Their biggest sources of revenue are income taxes and sales taxes. And the income taxes, interestingly enough, they're very high rates. They're above 50%, but the top marginal tax rate kicks in at a very low level. In the case of Denmark, I believe it kicks in at 10% above the median wage. So that means many, many, many people, you know, almost half the population is actually paying the top marginal rate. And then the sales tax, of course, sales taxes are famously regressive. Everybody pays a sales tax if you buy stuff. And so that is their, you know, another huge, their VAT is a huge source of revenue. So what these are, they're not socialist states. They're very capitalist free market states that do happen to have large welfare states, but they're financed by everyday people. They're not, they don't concentrate the cost of this on the wealthy. So, you know, they're one of my favorite Thomas Sowell phrases is there's no solutions, only trade-offs. And this is the trade-off. If you want to finance a very healthy welfare state, you got to keep a couple things in mind. One, you can't strangle your market through regulations, barriers to trade, barriers to entry, bad monetary policy. You've got to be open for business if you want to make sure that you have a thriving economy that can finance your welfare state. And then two, you can't put the costs or hope that you can finance an extremely generous welfare state by just foisting the costs on the wealthy. It's got to be kind of a shared responsibility. Now, if you want that and you think that's a good system, that's great. But let's just open our eyes to what that actual system is.
Yeah. And even F.A. Hayek said we could get the level of public services and things that we desire and wish to pay for in his arguments in Law, Legislation, and Liberty and in the Constitution of Liberty. So he wasn't opposed. Austrians were not opposed to offering whatever the public agreed was a public good and would serve them and that they were willing to pay for. And I think that that's a bottom line in health that is also makes it very difficult sometimes to solve the problem is it is expensive and we want someone else to pay for it, which is sort of human nature, I think. It's how we order when we go out on somebody else's dime for dinner sometimes. Well, I so appreciate your sharing. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I mean, this has been such a fun conversation. I love that we managed to touch on everything from the socialism of the socialist states to the socialism of certificate of need. you know, it's the central planning, I should say. You know, it's really been a fun conversation. I really appreciate everything you do, Bobby. You're always so fun to talk with, and you're so informed. And I just thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, because you've brought a wealth of information. And I think everyone who's heard this conversation will recognize how relevant some of these theoretical ideas are when they hit the ground for real people. So thank you so much for sharing that, and appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason, as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.